I'm Marty Moscoe-Wayne. Welcome to Radio Times. It's not been easy to be an older woman in America. While colonial women found a place for themselves by being useful, an older woman living alone at that time could be accused of being a witch. Back in the olden days, having gray hair was in as long as you didn't flaunt it. By the 1920s, gray was out as the new and younger woman arrived on the scene. Gail Collins writes about middle-aged and older women in her new book, No Stopping Us Now, who have defied the rules and stereotypes and moved the country forward. Some are household names: Sojourner Truth, Eleanor Roosevelt, Helen Gurley Brown, the notorious RBG, Nancy Pelosi. Others are less famous women: an African-American stagecoach driver, Mary Fields, writer Frances Willard, who in the 19th century wrote a best-selling book about learning to ride a bike at the age of 53, Millicent Fenwick, the pipe-smoking grandmother of eight who represented New Jersey in the U.S. Congress. Gail Collins joins us here in our Philadelphia studios. She's a columnist for the New York Times. And Gail Collins, it's been a bunch of years. Nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Good to be back.
Are Americans, you think, uniquely obsessed with staying young and youthful, or certainly looking that way?
Right now in world cosmic history, I'm not sure.
Or cosmetic history.
I'm not sure that we're any crazier than, say, people in France or anywhere else. But certainly what I was trying to figure out with the book was what periods in our history did older women get regarded as like older men, people to be respected and, you know, who had accomplished a lot of stuff? And what periods were they the people who had to be stuck in a rocking chair in the corner because there was no point to them? And it really did go up and down and up and down and up and down. And what point do you get to be old? At what point does it count? I mean, the first colonists who were here, who were all guys, wrote back to England and said, please, please, please send us wives. And their standards were that they should be civil and under 50 years of age. So, you know, it depends.
Well, it certainly does depend. And you write that men outnumbered women 6-1 in those early days. So I wonder whether men were a little less picky.
Oh, not picky at all back then. Really. And that one of the two rules of why when older women are popular is if you're scarce, you can walk into town and be 90 years old and everyone will say, welcome, welcome, welcome.
Which raises the question about this sort of ebb and flow of when older women seem to be more popular, more respected. Mm-hmm. Was it about money? Was it just that when they had money, they had some respect?
I hate to say anything like that because it's so depressing. But when you look at history, the times that they were economically valuable, the times that they were actually producing assets in some way, shape, or form, were the times when they were regarded as the same way as men were. The times in which their only role was to be a mother were times in which, once the kids had grown, they had no point whatsoever, and then the rocking chair was dragged out and it was time to go in the corner.
Was it about then wealthy women, or was it just women who were able to somehow garner income or wealth for herself?
No, it wasn't about being wealthy. It was that the colonial women were a great example. The colonial women were farm wives. They weren't wealthy, but they made all the stuff. They made, we've got diaries, these women, I made 1,000 candles this year. One woman, you know, my mom came to live with us and she spun 33,000 yards of yarn this year.
Wow.
And you don't mind mom coming to live with you when that kind of wealth is being produced. And the colonial women produced critical, critical products that the family needed to live and that the family could sell to make more money. And young women wanted to hang out with older women because they could teach them how to do this stuff so they'd have it for their own families.
You write about a woman named Martha Ballard. She was a midwife. She worked in Maine, worked well into her 70s, working as a woman midwife.
Yeah, and a midwife back then was not like just you hang around at the hospital waiting for somebody to come in. You got on your horse at 2 o'clock in the morning and drove through snowstorms to go and help deliver a baby. It was not a job for the weak-willed, for sure.
But being a older single woman, this is in New England at that time, did have some risks. You quote a guy named Handsome Lake, and I have to say there are many really just delicious quotes in this book, but he says, every old woman with a wrinkled face, a furrowed brow, a hairy lip, a gobber tooth, a squint eye, a squeaky voice, or a scolding tongue, having a ragged coat on her back, a skull cap on her head, a spindle in her hand, and a dog or cat by her side, is not only suspected but pronounced for a witch.
You couldn't even have a dog.
Or a cat, for that matter.
Yeah. It was that was partly, well, Handsome Lake had a lot of problems of his own, but and he was sort of trying to work them out by attacking the older women who had a lot of power within his tribe, and you know, and he successfully did manage to pretty much overthrow what was a kind of a matriarchy that had been in existence before then. But you know, in general, the idea of older women hanging around was not popular, because they were in the way and they couldn't contribute anymore. And older women or younger women who did not marry were very unpopular, because there weren't enough women. And if somebody decided not to marry, that was some guy who was not going to be getting a wife.
Mm.
So it was not, there were no excess women whatsoever. So if you didn't get married, you were a witch or something equally bad.
And she might be a temptation, right?
Yeah, of course. And if you did get married, like in the South, the early South, people were just dropping like flies all over the place because of malaria and the other diseases that had not been conquered yet. And if you were healthy and managed to not get sick and die, you could go through 3, 4, 5 husbands and just collect your inheritances and build them up. If you managed to avoid the mosquitoes, it was a very good time to be a woman in the South.
Assuming you weren't a slave,
yes,
of course.
Of course.
How about with baby boomers today? I think you and I are probably around the same age, so mm-hmm. we're part of this boomer generation. Mm-hmm. How do you think we're defining or redefining old age?
I am happy and sorry to say that whatever this history of our country since World War II has been, that whatever the boomer generation is doing is going to be popular, you know. And suddenly people will be very interested in how it's going, and all the millennials will go, oh, my God.
No wonder they hate us, right?
Of course. Oh, my Lord. I'm hoarse. Important as a Generation X who's stuck between the millennials, who at least get to whine all the time, and the boomers who are, you know, all over the place getting in the way. It's the younger generations have reasons to give themselves names and be ticked off on occasion, I must say.
Is it one of the reasons, though, you wrote the book, just to understand your own status within America?
Sure. You naturally get interested. I've been writing women's history books for a long time, but you naturally get interested in the part that you're at, and that was part of the reason.
Well, it's interesting how evolution can then change the definition of what it is to be old. And I guess it's when, you know, reproduction is not part of the scenario, then all of a sudden you're put into a different category.
Yeah, especially always if your whole role in life is to be a mother. When the colonial housewives, as we said, were very valuable because they could make all this wealth, then suddenly people move to the cities. And a middle-class woman in the city has no economic role whatsoever. Her only point is to have children. And when you hit that point, as soon as you're done, then you're done, and it's all over.
Let me just linger a little bit on some of the early days. You found that colonial women, or maybe even women in the first part of this country, used bacon fat to prevent wrinkles.
Yeah, there were always, you know, little things to do, and the wrinkles were never popular. Even there must be somewhere sometime, but even in colonial America, bacon fat and all kinds of little spices and things that they would. And the one that really freaked me out was that the way to preserve your teeth theoretically was to rub them with a cloth soaked in honey.
Oh wow!
And this is one of the reasons why nobody had teeth back then. When I think about this era, I think, well, that was nice and that was nice, but nobody had any teeth. Oh, my God.
And that's maybe from rubbing honey on them, or just obviously there was no dental care.
No, there was no dental care. Nobody had any teeth. They found a skeleton of a 30-odd-year-old woman in Jamestown, and she had 5 teeth.
Wow.
You know, so you just have to think about that when you picture all of these heroines of days of yore. Most of them did not have teeth.
But it is interesting about the bacon fat. I mean, just the idea that you would apply something so greasy and potentially smelly on your face.
Well, yeah, but better than many of the other things they were putting on their faces at that point in time. And they had put some of the cosmetics that did exist then, ruined your face, you know, and hair dyes that exist then would cause your hair to fall out. I mean, none of the methods of looking more youthful worked at all back then. And the bacon fat was probably the most useful there was.
Yeah. There's a lot of, I mentioned this to you before we went on the air, there's a lot about hair in this book, women and hair. what to do about it, whether to dye it, what color it is, all of that.
It's an obsession from the very beginning, almost. And very early on, some state legislatures tried to pass laws making it illegal for women to dye their hair, because the theory was that they would then trick men into marrying them with their funny. But the dyes of that period, not a human being would be fooled by the way your hair looked when it was dyed. But that was that. Cosmetics, using cosmetics, should be illegal because women will trick men into marrying them when they're too old and so on.
In fact, you write about a Kansas lawmaker proposed making it illegal for a woman to wear cosmetics, quote, for the purpose of creating a false impression.
See, whenever people talk about that, I say, well, state legislatures, you know, the stuff happens there.
I mean, it didn't get passed,
no,
right?
No, it did. I don't think any of them did, but they were constantly coming up.
You also write about a woman named Lydia Maria Child. She wrote several books, one called The Frugal Housewife, which had a lot of very down-to-earth, I would say, suggestions for housewives. And then one about aging and called Looking Towards Sunset, about how to find happiness as an older woman. What did she come up with?
Lydia Maria Child just knocked me out. She was a person that people don't talk about much, but she, of her time, she was just a poor woman, but very tied into the intellectual leftist kind of crowd in Boston. And she started out writing household tips, which there weren't magazines until about then. And the idea that you would have a book that told you how to take care of your, or a magazine that told you how to take care of your house, how to cook things, what to do when this happened and that happened, was unthinkable. And it was important because this is one of the ways that the power of the older woman is being undermined, because suddenly young women feel, at least, that they can learn all this stuff. They can read about all this stuff. They don't really need their mother or their aunt telling them, you know, how to boil an egg or how to do something more important. So that was one of her creations. And then she got into, what does it mean that if there are women, middle class women, that don't have anything to do in particular, what does that mean? And she said, good works. And suddenly, for the first time, really, you have somebody saying, look, here you are, you're in the city, you're middle class, you've got nothing to do, your kids are growing up. What's going to happen? And her idea was, we will go out and do good works. And some of her good works were pretty depressing. It was
such
like
as
reading little poems to Tommy in the park all day long. And, you know, and Tommy was pretty boring himself. But she, you know, she also was a great abolitionist. She, you know, wrote about, you know, working to, you know, help end slavery. She just had all these thoughts. But the critical one she suggested to everybody was, for women, it's not just your family. If your family doesn't need you anymore, there's lots of other stuff you should be doing.
Well, let's take a very short break and then we'll get back to our conversation. Gail Collins is our guest. She's an award-winning op-ed columnist for the New York Times. She's also written a number of books, the newest one called No Stopping Us Now, The Adventures of Older Women in American History. We are marching through that history. We will get to present day. You can join us, 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen, and if you are just joining us, Gail Collins is our guest. She's a New York Times op-ed columnist. She's been at the Times something like 25 years. She's also been writing books, and the new one called No Stopping Us Now. What's interesting is you look at some of these women who have really been quote-unquote successful, but also made huge changes here in this country. They tend to be older women. If you look at some of the abolitionists, if you look at the suffragists, they tended to be older women as well. You write a lot about Elizabeth Cady Stanton.
She fits right into my theory here about older women and how you can figure out how to change things. She, it's interesting to me that this whole slavery issue was really a woman's issue in the North. It was Harriet Beecher Stowe wrote her book, and women were taught to think of slavery as a family issue, that families were being broken up, that young girls were at the mercy of slave owners, and they were very passionate. Their problem was that it was considered wrong for women to speak in public. You gave a talk in public and they burned down your theater, or they throw stones at you, or they did something. And even in the African-American community in the North, it was not considered usually proper for a black woman to speak out in public against slavery, especially a younger black woman, because it was that same vision of you're putting your body there on display. Oh, my God, this is wrong. So Elizabeth Cady Stanton, who had 7 or 8 children, a ton of children, just kept having children. And it drove Susan B. Anthony nuts. She kept saying, come on, we've got to do stuff. And one more baby here. But she figured it out. She suddenly said, yes, you're so right. But I did my duty, of course. I've raised all my children. That's obviously what women are supposed to do. But I did do that. And now I'm a grandmother. Look at my gray hair. I'm a grandmother. And I'm just going to be going around talking grandmotherly things to people. And she got away with everything. She would be in trains playing cards with soldiers in the middle of the night, and nobody complained because she was a grandmother, and she would go in and say, hi, it's me, the grandmother. Let's talk about our children and our home. But by the way, some children are enslaved in the South. Let's talk about that. And let's talk about women's suffrage. And divorce reform is one of my things too. Really radical stuff, but people just lapped it up because it was a grandmother telling these things to them.
Because they respected her, or it was just, oh, there's granny spouting off again.
I think it was a sense that you could not be harmed by a grandmother. Nothing she could do could be shocking or harming. And then you're sort of taking in her ideas. She gets the chance to share them all with you. And suddenly, Stanton's followers back east were looking at her getting away with all this, and they're suddenly writing odes to menopause. Oh, great menopause, come quickly so I can go out and do stuff. You know, it was a whole new way of thinking about things.
Eleanor Roosevelt was her nickname. I think her mother called her Granny. Because she was sort of an old lady when she was a little girl.
You know, there are some people who are always middle-aged. You know, they're kind of seem to be middle-aged when they're 10. But the great thing is they also seem to be middle-aged when they're 80. They're just, you know, they just have that way about them. And she was certainly, I think she had the greatest middle age of any American woman ever. I mean, the stuff that she did was just remarkable. She would travel all over the place looking at people who were never visited by government officials before, poor black families in Appalachian towns that had no money. She was overseas looking at wounded soldiers in the Pacific. She went places and sometimes traveled alone.
In fact, you write, she preferred in many ways to travel
alone. She liked to travel
alone
because she could go where she wanted to go. And right. And the Secret Service was driven so crazy by this that they taught her how to shoot a gun. So I just love the idea of her with her pistol, you know, driving around the country, doing whatever she's going to do, and going to see people who never got any attention from government before, bringing their stories back to Washington. She knocks me out.
Yeah. Pistol packing first lady, right? Well, speaking about grandmothers, I'm going to make a giant leap to Nancy Pelosi, of course, Speaker of the House.
That is a giant leap.
It is a giant leap, but I, you know, since we're on the grandmother track here, how do you see then her authority as a grandmother?
It's interesting. She could never have gotten away with the "I am just a grandmother, a humble grandmother, going around talking to you about how I raise my grandchildren," but she throws that in. You know, there she is. She's one of the most powerful people in the country. She's the strongest person standing up against Donald Trump in the entire country. And then she talks about her grandchildren, and it kind of calms things down a little bit. And I think it's just very funny and very smart. And it's also part of her. She thinks about her grandchildren when she's thinking about the stuff that's happening, and people like that.
I also think she uses that grandmother talking about her grandchildren as a way to describe our politics or even the president or just, you know, like small children misbehaving.
Yes. No better time to think of people of their small children running amok.
Let me just quickly reintroduce you. That's Gail Collins, and she's a columnist for the New York Times. She writes books. She's got a new one called No Stopping Us Now, The Adventures of Older Women in American History. We are sort of jumping around American history, and we'd love to have you join our conversation. You can send us a tweet at WHYY Radio Times. You can email us, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can also call us at 1-888-477-9499. Your title, No Stopping Us Now, is there some irony there? Because reading your book, there's stopping and there's starting, and there's stopping and there's starting when it comes to women and specifically older women.
Yeah, and the part about it that somebody else suggested the title to me, and what I liked about it was the idea that there's always been this vision that, well, you do this, you do this, you do this, and then you retire or your children go away, and then you're done. And the idea that's very clear right now in our society that women of any age can get back in there, can stay in there, can have careers that go on and on and on, or who can change over and save their city, save their community. You know, there's no stopping us now. That would be my thought.
Yeah. Everyone's living longer for the most part. I mean, there are parts of the country where people are actually not living longer, but nonetheless.
As a group, we are. And that's another thing I kept thinking about. We're aging longer and longer and longer. The number of women who are over 90 is just skyrocketing. And as we're aging, we're reproducing less and less and less. And if we're going to continue to have this antipathy toward the idea of large-scale immigration, we are moving very fast to a society in which older people are going to hang in there and do stuff as long as possible because there's so much of us, we just cannot, this country cannot afford for us just to all retire and go home and read books, which would be very nice, of course. But
it does sound nice.
We can't afford it. We're going to have to think of ways we can continue to contribute to society for all of our lives.
This is a real downer, but you do quote Sigmund Freud in here calling postmenopausal women vexatious and overbearing.
Sigmund was not much help on ever so many levels as you go on along. But yeah, there was a great in the 20s. If you look at American history, there were times that it worked out well for women and there were times that it didn't for older women. And the 20s were a time that did not work out well at all for older women. It was the flapper time. I think that the amount of material you needed for a woman's outfit dropped from, I think it was 19 yards to 7 yards in the course of just one decade. It was and the people who were the entertainers who had been these sort of large, buxom, middle-aged women who were on stage, you know, performing very large, very big, went out of style. And you had little children-like women who were on the screen in movies, and they looked, you know, they were so adorable and sweet. Yeah. And the first Miss America was 16 years old. She played marbles behind the set when she was practicing. It was just an era in which you could not be too young.
Well, it seemed that it worked out well or better for women and especially older women when there was a war on.
World War II is a great example of a time when you could just see how popular older women can become. They were, you know, we have Rosie the Riveter visions that we all have. But I ran into stories celebrating Josephine, the 80-year-old riveter, how wonderful it was that she's out there making airplanes, you know, at her age. Yes, go, go, go. And another magazine article I read saying how lovely it is to be in a restaurant and seeing 60 and 70-year-old women carrying trays of dishes around with a gleam in their bright eyes. Well, I don't know about the gleam, but the
it's all work.
The idea that you could not have too many older women filling in for the men that were gone away. It was a great era in which older women got a ton of respect.
And the country needed them, obviously.
That's because the country needed them economically. The country needed them to do all the work that men had been doing but couldn't anymore.
You quote a 1929 study, so obviously after World War I, before World War II, don't hire older workers because they're moody and irritable.
A lot of theories like that, which basically the message was you don't have to hire older people. What the hell? You know, just stick with the young ones. They don't know anything, and they'll be more responding to what you want to do. But, yeah, people make up things all the time about what older people are like if they want to discriminate against them for some reason.
So after World War II, you've got the 1950s, you've got the baby boom. In many ways, and we should be said, that women have always worked. So it's not as if everyone went home to raise children or to start a family. But nonetheless, it was a trend that really then set the trend for, I think, where we are today.
Yeah, and I always have to remind myself when I talk about women working as something that is very desirable, that there are women who are poor, who working at terrible jobs, who do not want to be working, and who you would like to release from their burden, if at all humanly possible.
Sure.
And it's not fair to clump them in with these women that I keep talking about here.
Helen Gurley Brown is an interesting person in the, I guess, the 1960s, but she had a message for women.
Yeah, she had many messages for women, some of them probably more useful than others. But one, her big one was, here I am, and I am middle-aged, and I am really hot. I'm very glamorous. And I, from the time I was young, I lived the same kind of life that men get to live. I had affairs. I, you know, enjoyed sex, and I didn't make any secret of it. And look, I did well. I had, you know, a great career. I have a magazine now. I'm an editor. I've got a great husband who really liked the fact that I was sexually experienced. That was a whole new message that had not gone out before. And her whole life, I mean, some parts of it were a little weird. I mean, she was having plastic surgery until she was in her 80s, I think. But it was just never stop, keep going. You can always be an attractive, desirable woman with a career.
She wrote Sex and the Single Girl.
Yeah. That was not the first time that had come up, the idea that you could live alone. Living alone was, as you said, you're crazy, you're a witch. You know, it's the lady witch down the street who lives by herself. But then in the 20s, women started saying, hey, you know, it's kind of fun. I can have my own apartment. I can have a nice little brunch by myself. I can entertain friends. You know, I can take guys out if I want to, and I can pay if they can't. And it was a sense of liberation, but it didn't include sex. Mm-hmm. Helen Gurley Brown was the one who threw sex into the equation, too.
Well, the pill changed a lot.
My gosh. Well, until the pill, you could reduce the number of children you were going to have. I mean, people knew how to do birth control. But what you couldn't do was guarantee that you would not get pregnant over a prolonged period of time. And if you wanted any kind of a career that required a lot of preparation, medicine or law, anything like that, you really had to dedicate yourself to perpetual chastity. There was just no other way you were going to get through it. And then suddenly the pill came, and overnight the number of women applying for graduate school, law school, medical school shot up like an arrow instantly. It was just incredible.
Just knowing that I can prevent pregnancy and then take care of my career, my education.
I can have a marriage or a normal sex life, and I can have a career, and I can go to law school for whatever number of years I need, and it'll be okay.
James has a question. Can your guest talk about the work and incident that involved Angela Grimke at the Pennsylvania Hall in 1938? You do write about the Grimkes. They were abolitionists. Pennsylvania Hall was really right where we're sitting here, which was burned down. The mob went crazy.
The Grimke sisters just knocked me out. They were the product of a Southern family, an average wealthy Southern family who had slaves and everything else. And I've never figured out what happened, but the two of them were just raised like everybody else and just at some point said, no, this is all really wrong. We're not going to do this. And they went north and they became public speakers. They went around the country and gave speeches in that period that I was talking about when you were not supposed to do that. And people did burn down their halls, you know, throw stones at them. They went through a lot, but they were just popped along, you know, in the nicest way. And then much, much later in their lives, they're living. One of the very cool things was that Angelina was one of the first advocates of women's rights. I mean, and everybody said, well, why not? She's very peculiar. She can do that. And she got married. She got married to an abolitionist who she fell in love with when she was in her 30s. And the whole world was going, oh, my God, a woman, she's going around making speeches. She has her career. She's in her 30s. And, oh, my gosh, she's getting married. It was just incredible. But the three of them, she, her sister, and her husband, and her had a little commune they founded in their old age, and they're sitting there with their tiny bits of money, you know, running along, and suddenly one of them hears about this young man who says his name is Grimke out there, and they look into it, and they find out that he is the son of one of their brothers and a slave that, you know, that happens so often, you know, that the owners would, you know, grab a female slave and molest them. And so they called him in, and they adopted him, and they saved whatever little teeny-weeny bits of money they had to send him to law school. I mean, I just these are my favorite people in the whole world.
We were talking about Eleanor Roosevelt. You say some interesting things about Mamie Eisenhower, a real fashion plate. She was 56 when Ike was elected president, and she says, I hate old lady clothes, and I shall never wear them. She really cared deeply about how she looked.
Yeah, and if you look at her stuff now, I think a lot of people who are more sophisticated than I am would say, wow, this is a very interesting forward-looking look. And most people would probably say, wow, that's a lot of rhinestones there.
Yeah. You know, kind hanging of dowdy, around. Maybe?
Yeah, but at the moment, it was considered to be, you know, quite the – she loved pink. That was her color. And she loved Ike, and she was the first lady, I think, who had displayed affection to her husband in a serious way. You could really tell they physically liked each other when they were, you know, walking around hand in hand, going to meetings, going to public events. They would eat TV dinners in front of the TV at night together. I just love that idea. And when Ike had a heart attack, I think it was, he went to the hospital. She followed him. She lived in the next room. And the only thing she asked of the staff was that she get a pink toilet seat in her bathroom.
Because she had a thing for pink.
Pink so much that that was going to be her defining thing.
I was very young when she was first lady. Yeah. Was she reviled? Did anyone care that she cared about fashion so much? Do we know?
I'm sure there were people that did, but mostly people really loved her. I mean, she was cheerful. She was much more outgoing than the idea that she didn't make speeches, but she would come running on stage saying, "Here I am, here I am," and they were for the first time buttons saying, "Vote for Ike and keep Mamie in the White House." So that sort of vision of a popular first lady was first really, really promoted by the media at that point.
Well, let's take another short break and then we'll get back to our conversation. Our guest is Gail Collins on Radio Times today. She's an op-ed columnist for the New York Times, and she's won a number of awards for her op-ed columns. And she's got a new book called No Stopping Us Now, The Adventures of Older Women in American History. We're going to take a very short break, get back to our conversation, and open up the line once again, 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Much more to talk about after the short break. We'll be talking about some more current news and history as well. So do stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoe talking with Gail Collins about her new book, No Stopping Us Now. Let me play a couple of ads. They're from the 1970s. The first one, a 1971 TV ad for Geritol with the infamous tagline, "My wife, I think I'll keep her."
My wife's incredible. She took care of the baby all day, cooked a great dinner, and even went to a school meeting. And look at her. She looks better than any of her friends. She takes care of herself. Gets her rest, does her sit-ups, watches her diet, and to make sure she gets enough iron and vitamins, she takes Geritol every morning. Makes me take it, too.
More than twice the iron of ordinary supplements, plus 7 vitamins. Take care of yourself. Take Geritol.
My wife. I think I'll keep her.
Yuck. Here's another ad from 1972, a TV ad for Loving Care Hair Color Lotion with another infamous tagline, "You're not getting older, you're getting better."
You look like no 18-year-old could, 'cause you're a woman, and I see you're not getting older.
Hair color that gives you not just better color, better hair. You're not getting older, you're getting better.
I love those male voices there, Gail Collins.
They look like they're about to pounce, don't they? They really do. You know, they're both so. You know, I have to say about Geritol, there was a lot of alcohol in Geritol.
Is that right?
It was one of the reasons it made you feel so perky when you took a little bit of it back then. And I looked at the copy for the "You're not getting older, you're getting better" line, which I remembered so well from when I was a kid. And the copy in the ad then says, "These days, a woman who's 25 is old." And I thought, wow, we went from the 50-year-old wife that the colonists were dying for to 25 and you're old, it's all over for you in that tiny bit of time.
Yeah. Well, it shows you just how pliable, how flexible this idea of what is old anymore.
Totally. And that, and it comes and it goes and it comes and it goes, and it sends the message that you'd better probably ignore the theories and just move on with your life.
A caller is interested in Maggie Kuhn. She started the Gray Panthers. Mm. She was a Philadelphian, I have to say. I interviewed her several times. She died a number of years ago, but early on in Radio Times, interviewed her. She was a force of nature. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that she proudly said is, I am an old woman.
Never stopped, and she never stopped. I interviewed, unfortunately, she was gone before I started the book, but I interviewed Senator Ron Wyden, who people know now. He's the Democrat who's the ranking Democrat in the Finance Committee in the Senate. And he was a Gray Panther when he was in his 20s. He was a lawyer and working in poverty law, and ran into Maggie Kuhn and found her to be the most effective organizer of people of any age he had ever known. And he, you know, I think lived in one of the maybe Maggie Kuhn communes for a while.
Yep.
She had communes of young and old people all together. And some of them, I think, were very sexually active at the time. But she was a pistol in every way, shape, and form. But her idea was not just to fight for old people, but to fight, join older people with everybody else and fight for the things that everybody needed.
And I should add, she had a very young boyfriend.
I've heard that said.
Well, let's talk about Elizabeth Warren, who is, I believe, 70 years old.
70 years old.
Obviously, she's sort of inching her way up mm-hmm. to the top, mm-hmm. I would say, top three candidates.
She's definitely in the top three.
She's definitely in the top three. What do you make of her?
Well, you know, I love this. This is so funny, and I just love mentioning it. You've got three candidates, the top three candidates
For
the Democratic nomination, are all in their 70s. And the one that nobody talks about age about is Elizabeth Warren. The woman is the one who's not being discussed in terms of her age because she's such a bumblebee. She runs around. She's so energetic. She takes 10,000 selfies a day. And you just don't think of her in terms of age. Whereas Joe Biden and Bernie Sanders, that's the conversation everybody has. So I sort of like this moment for that matter.
Well, is it just that she's so lively?
It is. And both of them are not at their liveliest point in their life, I think it's fair to say. But it both shows how lively a woman can be at that age. But also I like to think that it's just part of the breakdown that you're seeing all over the country, and it's taken longer, I think, than many women had hoped. But you see the number of women who are now coming into the House and into the Senate, and someday governors, God help us, but that's the next thing. And you know, it's just a matter of getting used to.
Here's a very shallow comment. She doesn't have a lot of lines. I don't know if she's been using that bacon fat or...
It must be the bacon fat.
Whatever. I don't know if that, you know.
I don't have any gossip for you on that front.
fair enough. Kate says, this is one of our callers, says that she started a new business at 74. Her mother in her 80s climbed mountains, but it all comes down to the importance of health care and financial stability. And clearly, especially because women do live longer than men, you have to be able to prepare as best you can for that kind of future.
Yeah, and one of the reasons that things are changing so much for older women is that so many of them have had careers and were money makers during their married life, and that they can therefore move on and continue to do that. And the even when I was talking about the teeth, I mean, you know, whenever I think about it, it's a good metaphor for what's happened for people in general with our health and our age. You know, we got to have teeth now. I mean, nobody asks about that stuff anymore. And that's true of so many things as far as health goes. You can just bounce right along for a very long time.
A caller actually feels like we are trivializing this topic, that there should be more outrage about women. Gail Collins and Marty are trivializing the topic by laughing about it.
You know, I find that that's the easiest way to get people to think about stuff, actually, is to, you know, make them not want to throw themselves out the window, but kind of talk about how silly these things are and, oh, my gosh, how ridiculous. As a columnist, when I started, I would spend all my time writing about the New York City Council and how terrible it was. And it was awful. It really was awful, but still. And one day I just got up and I thought, I just don't want to make people throw themselves out the window after they read the column. I want to tell them what's going on in a way that will make them want to talk about it and think about it again. So I apologize if it sounds like I was trivializing the issue, but I just find this the best way to get a message across.
Well, I mean, your columns are that way. As someone who reads you, I mean, to sort of find that bitter irony, I mean, it's there.
It's sort of what I did. One time many years ago, when Donald Trump was having all of his terrible problems financially, you know, I referred to him in a column as America's most famous thousandaire. He was very bitter about that one. I can tell you, his response was not pleasant.
What do you make of our president?
Well, you know, I've still got his letter from that period that I kind of put up on my wall. He sent me back my column with my picture circled with a little arrow pointing to it, saying, "You are a dog with the face of a pig. No wonder you're angry. I would be too." And he misspelled too. So
T-O,
yeah. So I've kept that sort of framed to remind me of where we are right now.
I don't like people using dogs in disparaging terms.
I know. It's very not fair. My dog would be opposed to that, too.
Mine as well. Let me ask you, and this is more very current day. This is the Army Lieutenant Colonel Alexander Vindman, who testified yesterday.
Yeah.
A member of the White House staff, the National Security Council. I mean, his biography is incredible. Came to the country as a three-year-old from Ukraine, mm-hmm. of all places, fleeing the Russians, the Soviet Union, settling in, going to Harvard, getting a Purple Heart from his being injured in Iraq. He testifies about what he believes happened in the phone call related to Ukraine and the president. And he is ripped to shreds.
By the president.
By the president and others as well.
And his supporters. But the interesting thing to me, and this may be a moment, is that even many of the Republicans who have not broken with the president took that opportunity to say, no, this is a guy who served the country well. You can't be demeaning him that way. It's not the same as saying impeach Donald Trump, but I think it's a sign of separation there. And it took a lot. And, you know, you take a national hero and you have, you know, who's speaking his truth, and then watch what happens to him. But I think this is going to be seen as a turning point when even, you know,
Cheney, right?
Yeah. Some of the president's supporters said, look, we can't go here. This is not a place we're prepared to go.
I'm thinking about John McCain, you know, what President Trump or then candidate Trump said about John McCain and the Gold Star family who spoke at the Democratic Convention. Mm-hmm. You know, I just maybe grew up thinking those people were off limits. You know, if you've served your country and you paid in certain ways the almost ultimate price.
And you'd like to think, I mean, one of the important things we're dealing with today is you'd like to feel that we have national standards and that no matter who gets elected president, whatever he or she wants to do, whatever their policies are going to be, they're going to abide by certain standards of what our leader represents and what he or she is going to do. And one of those things is you don't insult war heroes. I think that's a little, you know, bottom line thing that we can expect. And, you know, there aren't any limits for this president. And I think that's going to come and bite him in the end.
Is he hurting our country?
Sure. And we'll see how much when we see what happens in the next election. I mean, if in the next election he gets reelected, that's the country affirming that they think this is a proper way to behave. I'm hoping that that won't happen, that the country will say, okay, might have liked some of your ideas, but this is not the way we want our leader to represent us. We'll see what happens.
How do you see the impeachment process? You know, you lived through Clinton. Nixon almost got impeached. He left before that could happen, but I think it was pretty probable that he would have been. How do you see how that process is moving along?
You know, it makes me really miss the Clinton impeachment. It was so, it was all about sex, really, when you got down to it. And I had just published at the time a book about political scandals, and we were having editorial meetings about what now we can write about. And once in a while, my editor would say, yeah, can you write about Grover Cleveland again and his sex scandal? Let's just rest us here a little bit. Let's talk about Grover and his sex scandal, because there had been some before, but there's never been anything like this. And I've never seen anything that seemed likely to, I mean, there's, in which both parties are so completely divided and there's no ability to work together to come up with a solution in Congress. It's very scary.
Yeah. Let me get Barbara from Philadelphia to join our conversation. And Barbara, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Good morning.
Morning.
So I happen to have lived with Maggie Coon during the 1980s, and I just wanted to, actually the late 70s and the early 80s, clarify, you know, people might think of commune as in a particular way, and I just wanted to clarify because I think it's important in context. In the times when Maggie Coon bought a home, it's extremely difficult for a woman to get a mortgage. Little, you know, there were no credit cards. You couldn't sign for a mortgage. She had to learn how to live in that kind of society. She had her house broken up into apartments. We rented an apartment from her for a long time. And other people did, too. And she had relationships with the seminaries in the area, and students would come and stay there. So I just wanted to say that her social justice perspective was part of her whole life, the way she lived her life, and even just because of her access to resources. So she's a very wonderful mentor to so many of us out there.
I'm sure, Barbara, and I appreciate the call. Go ahead.
And what, one of the things that Barbara said that I think is nice to mention is the whole commune issue. There was such a long time in women's history in which women, facing up to the fact that women lived longer than men, that women were often left alone without even the ability to support themselves because they'd been housewives and mothers. And there was a lot of talk for a very long time about communes. We'll establish communes and all live together and support each other. And one of the saddest things about my whole research here is that it didn't really work out. You never got to that point. I remember when I was younger talking with my friends about how we were going to have an old age commune and we were all going to live together. And
I remember those conversations.
Yeah. It almost
whatever happened
never,
to that?
I don't know. It almost never happens, and it is a shame. What you get now is retirement communities, which are sort of old age communes for wealthier old age people. But that vision of the old age commune, I God bless Maggie Kim.
Let me just squeeze one more clip in, and this is California Democratic Representative Katie Hill. She announced her resignation from Congress on Sunday after allegations surfaced accusing her of having an inappropriate relationship with a former campaign staffer, and she says she's a victim of revenge porn. Just a very quick.
Hi, I'm Katie Hill. And last night, I announced the most difficult decision of my life, that I would be resigning from Congress. I made this decision so that my supporters, my family, my staff, and our community will no longer be subjected to the pain inflicted by my abusive husband and the brutality of hateful political operatives. This coordinated campaign carried out by the right-wing media and Republican opponents, enabling and perpetuating my husband's abuse by providing him a platform, is disgusting and unforgivable, and they will be held accountable. But I will not allow myself to be a distraction from the constitutional crisis we're faced with and the critical work of my colleagues.
What do you make of her resignation?
I'm very sad, but it's part of, in a way, the new story. If women are going to be working on the same levels as men in politics, revengeful spouses will be doing stuff like that. You've got to kind of prepare for that. You've got to prepare to not have relationships, sexual relationships with people who are working for you, because that's gotten a number of men in trouble. And it's rules that I think women will pick up on very quickly and understand. I'm sorry that she got caught up in it.
Well, Gail Collins, thank you so much for joining us today on Radio
Thank
Times.
You.
And her book is called No Stopping Us Now, The Adventures of Older Women in American History. And she is an op-ed columnist for The New York Times. Go to WHYY.org/Radio Times. And you can find out more about the program. You can download a podcast of the show. You can find us on Facebook. You can follow us on Twitter. Diana Martinez, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Builder, John Ahrens, and Kelsey Hansen. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Thank you so much for joining us.